Good morning.
It's really good to be here and good to be able to share with you once again. I'm slightly distracted by the sheep at my feet. I don't know what you guys are doing, but I'm going to eat all 10 of them right here. It's good to be here, and it's really good to be able to start our series on Lent this morning. And that's essentially what I'm going to be thinking about, is what Lent means for us. Don did kind of draft me in slightly late notice when he realised he wasn't going to be here this morning and didn't give too much direction on where he wanted me to take the Lent series. He did kind of say, just go in any direction you want to go in. So this morning I'm going to speak on tigers. No, not really, but hopefully I won't contradict too much of where Don might take us next week. But before we get into thinking a little bit about Lent, let me take you back to Hogmanay 2016. Myself and Charlie were engaged, but she was had moved back to America in San Diego while we worked through the visa process. And so I decided after Christmas to go over to San Diego and spend New Year with her. For any of you who know your American geography well, you'll know that San Diego is quite far south in America. In fact, it lies just about 10 miles from the Mexico border. So essentially, it operates as something like a border town. It's quite bilingual in many ways. When we went to get tacos, for example, off a street vendor, he spoke more Spanish to his customers than he did English. So San Diego lies very close to the Mexico border. So we decided on Hogmanay. Why it was Hogmanay, I'm not too sure, but we decided on Hogmanay to go and see the border wall. Before Donald Trump came to be president, I don't think many people realized just how much of the Mexico-America border did in fact have some kind of fortified wall or barrier. But it usually occurs along large urban areas, populous areas, and the San Diego-Tijuana border is definitely one of the busiest crossing points. So they have this big fence that separates the America-Mexico along the America-Mexico border. On the American side, they say there's a nature reserve. It's really just scrubland, to be honest. And we had to park about a mile away. And we were walking along the beach to get there. And it sounds quite nice, except it was quite dull and grey and damp, which is unusual for San Diego, I have to say. Not so unusual at the end of December. But we were walking along the beach, quite a grey day. Got to this border fence, and we were the only ones there. San Diegans aren't known for going out in the rain. The only ones there, apart from a border guard who was sat in his vehicle, probably with a gun, wondering why on earth these two people had trudged the mile to get to the border wall on Hogmanay. It wasn't exactly very inspiring. In fact, it was quite dull, it was quite stark, and not particularly inviting. As we got towards the border wall, I could see the other side. I wasn't able to go across the border, but I could see over the fence. And on the Mexican side, they have a big stadium right up against the wall. In times past, it's been a bullfighting stadium, now hosts concerts. And as we got closer and closer, I could hear a mariachi band playing. They were having some kind of festival, some kind of fiesta happening on the other side of the border. And so you have this contrast of the American side being quite dull, stark, uninspiring, boring. And the Mexican side, this party going on, this music coming across. And I thought to myself, I'm definitely on the wrong side of the border here. So I got this image in mind. And I want to refer to this story a couple of times throughout this morning. And I think the first illustration that I want to draw from it is that contrast between something that's dull and uninspiring to something that seems life-giving on the other side. And it strikes me that as we come into a period of Lent and into Easter, that our fasting and our feasting in the church, has, particularly in the Western Protestant church, has become largely dull and uninspiring, almost to the point that we very rarely talk about it. And yet there's something within us that says, surely there's more to this idea of fasting and feasting. Surely there should be something more life-giving to it than we generally experience in the church. It strikes me that our fasting has lost something of the compassion and the empathy that it should have. And we've kind of turned it inwards a lot of the time. And our feasting has lost something of the joy that should come along with feasting. And I don't just mean that kind of frivolous excitement or celebration, but a deep sense of joy that comes from a certain hope. And so it strikes me that our fasting and feasting has become largely dull and uninspiring. As we go into Lent, I've been thinking about what people have been maybe giving up for Lent. And it strikes me that a lot of the time, the things we give up are often self-righteous acts of self-discipline. And that might sound slightly harsh, but it seems to me that a lot of the time we kind of challenge ourselves to say, can I give up alcohol for Lent? Can I give up social media for Lent? And we kind of pitch it at saying, look how committed I am because I can do this for the 6 or 7 weeks, for the 40 days of Lent. Look how committed I am because I can give these things up, largely luxury items as well. And our motivation seems to me to come from somewhere of almost self-improvement. We kind of say, if I can give up chocolate and crisps for Lent, then maybe by summer I can fit into my bikini. There's an image that you don't want on a Sunday morning. But our acts of fasting often have become self-righteous acts of self-discipline, motivated from a self-improvement. And you can probably hear that theme coming through there. Our fasting has quite often become about ourselves. We've turned it inwards on ourselves and it lacks a sense of compassion and empathy. And I'm not sure that our feasting has actually done much better. Certainly at Christmas time, we seem to be a little better. We seem to be able to celebrate well. We seem to have a real sense of joy and we do well at spreading hope at Christmas time. Although in the back of our minds, it still niggles us that if we celebrate too hard, then maybe this will become too consumeristic. But definitely as we look towards Easter, I think we really struggle to celebrate Easter well. I don't know whether it's because Easter is almost too focused on the cross. Now hear me well when I say that when we focus on the cross, we focus on our guilt and our sin. And we can't quite shift beyond the shadow of death that seems to linger over Easter to celebrate the joy and the hope of the resurrection. And so we always struggle to really celebrate Easter well. And so our fasting and our feasting has become largely dull and uninspiring. And I want to share with us over this morning maybe a couple of ideas that might help reinvigorate our fasting and our feasting, maybe inspire them a little bit more. If we turn to the Old Testament, we see the people of Israel. And as they go through the Old Testament and into the intertestamental periods and the Second Temple period, we see that they've built up this cycle of fasting and feasting. Nearly the whole year is packed full of fasting and feasting, and they go from one feast to another feast. And for the people of Israel, these fasts and feasts marked episodes from their history, whether that's Purim that was commemorating Queen Esther, whether it was the Passover and the Exodus, whether it's Hanukkah or whichever festival it is, they reenact, they recall to mind episodes in the history of the people of Israel that has shaped their identity and who they are. And so their fasting and feasting becomes a sense of their corporate identity through a collective memory. It reminds them who they are, who they were called to be, and what they are meant to be. And so their fasting and feasting brings to mind this collective memory, this corporate identity. Oliver O'Donovan, in his book The Desire of Nations, says that the church should be the recapitulation of the Christ event. Essentially, by that, he's saying that the church should reenact Christ's life, death, resurrection, and ascension. Essentially, the church's identity is to be rooted in who Christ is and was and what Christ did and will do. And he developed this idea by looking at fasting and feasting. He says that our fasts should recall to mind times of absence. As we think about absenting something from our lives, giving something up from our lives, that our fast should recall to mind moments of absence in Christ's life. Essentially says that fasts should recall to mind Christ's death and his ascension. In Christ's death, we remember, we recall to mind that Christ took on the fragility of life. And in taking on the fragility of life, he became obedient even to death, and in some way experienced a loss. And so in our fasting, we are recalling that to mind. We are able to empathize then with people who are also experiencing grief, or people who are experiencing some kind of fragility of life, ill health. And we are able to empathize and have compassion in the times of fasting. And it also recalls to mind Christ's ascension and the loss felt. Now, this isn't a loss that was a permanent removal of Christ. We know Christ is coming back. But even a sense of distance and a sense of loss, we recall that to mind in our fasting. And so we're able to empathize, have compassion on those who are also experiencing a loss or absence. Perhaps it's an absence of food for those who are hungry, an absence of wealth for those who are in poverty, an absence of justice for those who are experiencing oppression. Our fasting, therefore, becomes times where we can have compassion and empathy, that we can connect with people who are experiencing loss, grief, ill health, injustice. And in our fasting, we are to recall that to mind. We are to have compassion and empathy. And in our feasting, we are recalling to mind Christ's resurrection and Christ's ultimate return as well. Our feasting are times of abundance and joy. In Christ's resurrection, we recall to mind the abundance of life, that life-giving spirit that called Christ back to life, that we give that sense of joy of life to others. And in his ultimate return, we recognize that ultimate hope that we have, that Christ is coming again, that God is reconciling all things to himself. And so in our feasting, we can reenact, we can recall to mind this abundance of life, this joy and this hope. And so our fasting and feasting becomes the reenactment of Christ's life. But hear me well on this. Fasting and feasting have to go together in this sense, that we can't have one without the other. We can't have the fast without the feast, or the feast without the fast. Because if we only think about the fasting, the absence, and the loss, then we get overwhelmed by the suffering in the world. Our heads go down, and we get consumed by the grief, or the loss, or the hardship. But at the same time, if we only focus on the feasting, it can almost be more damaging, because we can get into the situations where we lack compassion and empathy, and people come to us and say that they are unwell, and we say it's because you just don't have enough faith. Or people come to us and say that they are struggling with poverty or injustice, and we say, well, we won't do anything, but we'll pray for you. Or we come to church on a Sunday and people are struggling and going through hard times, and we tell them you should be joyful. We lack the compassion and empathy if we only focus on the abundance, and if we only focus on the hope. We need the two together, that we might be able to empathize, have compassion with those who are in difficult situations, but also be those agents of joy and agents of hope that can say, but we know that Christ is reconciling all things to himself. And so our fasting and feasting becomes infused with compassion, with empathy, with joy and hope, holding the two together, that we might be agents of hope to a suffering world. The second illustration that I want to take from my initial story was the mariachi band that was playing. Mariachi bands are the traditional Mexican bands that really have that upbeat, fast-tempo music that you often hear at fiestas or carnivals. And I want to think of that idea of fiesta and carnival. Interesting words here. Fiesta is related to our English word feast. That probably makes sense. Carnival, though, is a really interesting word. The carne part of carnival is the same root as our word carnival or carnivorous, which is about meat eating. Or chili con carne, if you want. It's another example of it. It's actually the same root of the word that we get incarnation from. In that sense, it's about flesh, and so incarnation is taking on flesh. But it's really this idea that carne means meat. And so a carnival, the word carnival, is the celebration, the eating of meat before the fast. And the carnival season lasted from sometime in December right the way through to Lent. And it was essentially the season of using up all the meat that you'd stored up over winter before it went bad and before it would get replenished in the springtime. And so the carnival was essentially a feast before the fast. Some of you this week might have had pancakes on Tuesday. And essentially, Pancake Day is a carnival. Now, you might not really think of it as a carnival, but it's the same root as Mardi Gras. Again, for those who know French, Mardi is Tuesday, and Gras is fat. And so Mardi Gras is Fat Tuesday, the time that we use up all our fats before the fast. So Pancake Day, Mardi Gras, very much similar ideas. I learned this week that in Germany, they also have a festival called Rose Monday, which is the same idea. They give out sweets before Lent. It's on Shrove Monday. And so all of these ideas are connected. Carnivals and feasts essentially have an inherent link to religious festivals. They are the feast before the fast. A couple of writers have picked up this idea of the link between carnivals and feasting and the religious links. Most recently, Kester Bruin has written about this. And they always depict carnivals of times of social gatherings. If you've seen images of Mardi Gras, then you'll probably know what I'm talking about. But carnivals are times that people tend to dress up in costumes, put on masks, and it's for the whole town, the whole city to gather together. And the interesting thing is, when you put on a costume and you put on a mask, it doesn't matter whether you're the highest in society or the lowest in society, but everyone is gathered together, and you might rub shoulders with the greatest or the least in society. And so a carnival is this kind of time of social dissolution, where the social order, the class system is dissolved, and everyone is invited to partake equally in the carnival. And so carnivals were essentially times that challenged the social organization. There are a number of examples of these feast days, of these carnivals, that go one step further than even just social dissolution to social inversion. There is one feast called the Feast of Fools, which is quite interesting. At the Feast of Fools, there were a couple of different traditions that showed this social inversion. One of them was to take the churchman, the priest, or the bishop, and seat them backwards on a donkey, parade them through the town, and people would mock them. We won't suggest that to Don. But the idea was taking the powerful institution of the church and humiliating them, reminding them of their humble position. Another tradition was to take ordinary townsfolk, commoners, and make them king and queen for the day, essentially inverting this social order. The role of the fool is quite interesting, as this was the Feast of Fools. The role of the fool is quite interesting. You might think of it as the jester in the king's court. The jester would be known, would be amongst the advisors of the king, albeit maybe the lowest in the king's court, but he would still be there. And you see this in something like King Lear by Shakespeare quite prominently, that if the king made a bad decision or put forward a bad idea, then it should be the role of the advisors to say, no, that's a bad idea. But no one really wants to challenge the king, because the king might turn around and say, right, you're out. And so even if it was a bad idea, the advisors kind of shrunk back a wee bit. And it was left to the jester, who could couch this objection, this truth-telling, in terms of humour and in terms of entertainment. But the fool in the king's council then suddenly became the truth-teller, the wise one in the council. And so there is again this inversion of expectations, this inversion of social order. Now, maybe you've already heard some of the resonances of the biblical themes that come through there. The idea that the last shall be the first, the commoners becoming the kings and the queens. The idea that Paul says about God using the foolish of the world to shame the wise. Not the unintelligent as such, but that God's order, God's kingdom is upside down. That he'll use those who are seen as foolish in the eyes of the world to shame the wise of the world. And so carnivals become representations of imagination, thinking about a better world. When we dissolve the hierarchies, the social systems, the high and the low, to create a more equal society, societies that are free from oppression and injustice, societies that are ordered in a way that are ordered in line with what God wants. And so carnivals are these moments, albeit temporary, where we can imagine a better world for everyone. And so our feasting times should be these times of social reimagination. The third image that I want to bring from the story that I shared at the beginning leads us back to borders themselves. And borders are interesting phenomenon, depending on how you view them. Some people think of borders as barriers. They see them as places where people are separated in an effort, I guess, to protect some kind of unique identity. A border separates them, keeps them apart. It sets up a sense of us versus them. But for other people, borders become crossing points. They become points of connection where two disparate groups might be able to exchange ideas, or people might be able to cross and experience something of the other. And so in one sense, people imagine borders as places where people are pulled apart or separated. But in the other sense, borders are also crossing over points, points of connection. One seems to destroy relationships and the other helps to build relationships. And in some ways, this idea starts to draw together a couple of the ideas that I've already said. If we view fasting as something that is inward, that is only done for ourselves, by ourselves, or for the church, then it becomes something that is inward-looking and almost separates us from the world around us and says, this is just for me, or this is just about us. But if we reimagine fasting and feasting about times of compassion and empathy, about times of being agents of hope that go out and share that hope with people in a suffering world, then it becomes a point of connection. It becomes a crossing over point. And if we imagine carnivals not just about our feasting times, Christmas and Easter, things that we want to hold on to in the church for ourselves, that only we should celebrate, but we reimagine them as feasts and carnivals, as times of social reimagination, times where we look to create a better world, not just for us, but for everyone, then they become points of connection, points where we can build relationships. Dawn put for this morning the theme of lost and found. And I'm not exactly sure if he had in mind a link to Lent itself, but it did make me think that thinking about this idea of lost and found, they can quite easily become binaries that some are lost and some are found, some are in, some are out. We're in the church and we should separate ourselves from the world around us. But I'm not sure that that's a helpful way or a useful way of understanding ideas of lostness and foundness. Like we've already heard this morning, in Luke 15, Jesus tells the parables of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. But we need to read these in context. Jesus is eating with sinners, with the unexpected. And the Pharisees are challenging him, why are you doing this? And Jesus in these stories is trying to say, look, the 99 sheep who are there in the field already, that's the Jews, that's the Pharisees. You already know what it is to have a relationship with God. But I'm coming to redefine God's kingdom. I'm coming for the rest of the world, for all of my creation. You are the 9 coins that are safe and well. I'm looking for that one coin. And perhaps most poignantly and most pressingly, there is the lost son who, in the story, the elder brother has been in the house the whole time but is now upset that the master would want to bring in the prodigal, the returning son. And Jesus is challenging him, saying, why are you upset that you Jews are already saved? already know God, why are you upset that I want to bring the rest of my creation into my fold, into my household? And so rather than set up this binary of lostness and foundness, of who's in and who's out, Jesus is essentially breaking down these barriers and looking for more points of connection, looking for this border that is a crossing point in and out. I think a far better, in some ways, like the image in Luke 14 of the great feast that Jesus tells as a parable as well. And he said, he tells the story of a master who throws a great banquet and he goes to invite all those who you would expect to be there. I think he was thinking of the religious of the day. But all of them are too busy doing their own thing, too busy in their own religion, perhaps. And instead, the master says, well, go out into the country lanes, go out to the unexpected places and invite them, for they are sure to come. And right enough, they are the ones who turn up to Jesus, to the master's feast. And I think that's what Jesus is saying in these parables, that he is reconciling all things to himself, that he has come for everyone. God created the whole world, all of creation and everything in it. And he is reconciling all things to himself. Instead of building up barriers and who's in and who's out, he's breaking them down and saying, I've come for everyone. So as we go through this period of Lent and Easter, I hope that there's been something in this morning to reimagine it, to inspire it, that we can see our times of fasting and feasting as times of compassion and empathy, of times where we can become agents of joy and hope, reaching out, connecting with people who are suffering, that we might bring God's hope to them, that our carnivals, our feasting times can be times of social reimagining, times where we are looking to create a better world, not just for ourselves, but for all of creation, that we can connect with those in the world and say, this is how we are making the world a better place. And ultimately, that we are breaking down barriers. That it is not lostness and foundness as such, but it is God saying, I am reconciling all things to myself. And how are we going to be part of that reconciliation? How are we going to be part of God's plan to reconcile all of creation to himself? I hope that Lent and Easter this year is both challenging for you, but I hope that you find something throughout these next weeks that will inspire you to take on this idea of fasting and feasting.